equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
Good afternoon. I'm Carl Ettner, your host for Equal Time Radio on Mondays.
We've got a great show coming up for you today. On direction from the legislature, the Vermont Public Service Board has set some prices for renewable energy. These are guaranteed prices that are considerably higher than the lowest prices that utilities pay for their electricity right now. It's something the legislature did in order to bring these renewable energy projects online faster. We're going to talk about how that will affect your energy cost and reliability with Andrew Perchlik. He's the executive director of Renewable Energy Vermont. He'll also talk about Vermont's largest renewable energy event, their annual conference, coming up in October. Before that, we're going to talk with Nico Rubin of East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield. Got fruit and nut trees? And Nico will tell us how to care for your fruit and nut trees right now. Or if you don't have fruit and nut trees yet, he'll tell you why it's a good time to plant them now.
Hello, Nico.
Hello, Carl. How are you doing?
Oh, doing good. Good to hear your voice. Why don't you begin? We're going to get some tutorials on fruit and nut trees from you. Well, why don't we begin by you telling us what East Hill Tree Farm is?
East Hill Tree Farm is a nursery and a business assisting people in planting edible landscapes, home orchards, nut trees, berry plants. I do a lot of consulting, going out talking to people about what might work on their properties, and then helping them get the plants in the ground. I do a lot of also direct sale, people who come out, visit me in Plainfield, and pick up trees they're ready to put in the ground themselves. A lot of apple trees, pear trees, plum trees, elderberries. A great variety of things. Trying to just make it easier for people to be growing more of their own food, especially with woody plants, things that they're not going to have to replant every year, things they're going to be bearing more and more year after year.
And things that it requires a little bit of patience for as well.
Yes, it can require a little bit of patience. The vegetables they do come and go within one season for the most part, and that the apple trees, they take a few years before they start producing. But given 50 to 100 years of production, it's hard to argue, in terms of using your time efficiently with something like an apple tree or a pear tree.
Sure. And in the interest of full disclosure, I'll let you know, listeners, that I am a customer of the East Hill Tree Farm. Last year, I bought nearly 30 small trees from Nico Rubin, East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield. They were hazelnuts and filberts and hazelberts, these hybrids, to plant as a privacy hedge along the road. And he and a bunch of other people interested in permaculture came on out to my place and helped me plant them, gosh, just about this time of year, maybe a little bit later, maybe it was into October or November, I don't remember. Got them in the ground, and most of them made it through the winter, almost all of them made it through the winter and this year, and they've been really establishing themselves, so I'm pleased to see that.
I'm glad to hear it. Yeah, a lot of people are asking, if this is a good time to plant, and the answer is yes, absolutely. A lot of people say, I heard spring is the best time to plant, because, plants are still waking up. And it's true that spring is the best time to plant. Last spring, in fact, is the best time to plant. getting plants in the ground right now, they're going to have time, while the soil is still warm, to get a bit of root growth on them, on the site where they're going to be spending the rest of their lives, so that plants going in now are going to be ahead of anything put in next spring. It just gives them a little boost, that they're going to be happy, comfortable settling in over the winter. They're going to wake up next spring, happy, ready to go, in their new home.
There's a nurseryman in New York State who comes to the NOFA Winter Conference each year and gives some talks. And I believe his motto is something like that: the best time to plant a fruit tree is 15 years ago or today.
Right. Exactly.
So other than, the winter when the ground is just too frozen to get into, is there any time of the year from early spring to late fall when you'd advise people not to plant fruit trees?
It it really depends. I think that there's, you know, I've cut open frozen ground and tucked plants in, and then in the spring they've done just fine.
Huh.
And you know that there are these, you know, real dry, hot, breezy days, you know, in the middle of the summer, that if you've got a plant that hasn't been in a pot too long, or if you're trying to dig something up to move, you're likely to be exposing a lot of fine feeder roots that will get damaged in hot, dry weather. So that's one thing to watch out for. And you know, I have transplanted on those days, and if you have something that's got a solid root ball in your, you know, you've got it well watered before you take it out of the pot, and you get it right back into a cool, damp hole, the stress is really pretty low.
So it sounds more like you choose your weather, you choose your days, rather than you choose your time of year, anytime from early spring to late fall.
Exactly, and this time of year, the plants are generally going to be pretty well rooted in the pot. And you can be a little rougher handling the roots this time of year, because it's cool, and that, you know, the trees aren't putting on any new vegetative growth, so that, you know, stress to the root system doesn't actually set back the tree as much, because it's already shutting down its above ground parts for the winter.
Hmm. So how about bare root trees? Is that something only for the spring?
That is something only for the spring. You can also do it late fall. Once the tree has dropped all its leaves and really shut down its root growth, you know, and it depends on the species, certainly. But I'd say maybe the end of October for some things, and you know, just before the ground is freezing, you can dig up a plant, remove all the soil from the root system, and so that you've got just the woody roots left, and you can transplant that pretty smoothly. And then other than that, it's also the spring before the buds even start swelling. You can handle a plant with no soil on the roots.
And what's the advantage of planting trees with the bare roots, as you've just described?
Well, much easier to move a plant that doesn't have any soil on it. That's one of the major advantages. Other advantages, you can see the condition of the roots. You know that you're not going to have any roots that have wrapped in the pot. Sometimes plants growing in pots, especially for, you know, more than one or two seasons, the roots are going to start circling in the pot. And this is one of the few major drawbacks to growing plants in pots, the circling roots. And with a bare root plant, you know that, you know, none of the roots are circling. You can spread them out in the hole as you're planting, and they're never going to be a detriment to the plant in the future. Plants in pots, you can usually tell if the plant is root-bound, if the roots are circling. And unless it's been in a pot for really a long time, you can pull the roots apart when you're putting it in the ground to spread them out.
Mm. Mm. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Nico Rubin of East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield. Nico, you have a website, right?
Yes, I do. It's easthilltreefarm.com.
easthilltreefarm.com.
All one word.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's say we already have some fruit and nut trees right now. It's late September. What should we do with them? How should we be taking care of them, preparing them for winter?
Sure. It depends some on how the plant's doing. Clearing out grasses and, you know, any sort of thatch that's built up around the base of the trees is a great idea, because you know, just sort of reduce the amount of habitat for rodents right around the trees is a great idea, especially on smaller trees. Making sure that you've got some rodent protection in place for your fruit trees is a great idea. You know, anything smaller than an inch and a half, you know, at the base, is, you know, can get destroyed by rodents in one season.
The fruit trees especially, not so much the nut trees?
The nut trees, it seems to be less. I do put protection on the nut trees as well. But it definitely seems to go for them less. And just by limiting the amount of habitat and the conditions for rodents, you can do a huge amount. Having cultivated soil or a nice, even, you know, woody mulch that sort of doesn't create that optimal rodent habitat, you're going to have a lot less damage.
Let your cat out at night, that sort of thing.
Let your cat out, exactly. You know, in some cases, mowing around trees also reduces the amount of rodent pressure.
Mm-hmm. Now, one common mistake that I understand people make is putting too much mulch on a fruit tree.
Sure. Well, there's, I'm a big advocate for mulch. I think it does a huge amount, smoothing out transplant, maintaining sort of even soil temperatures and even soil moisture. However, one thing that does happen is that the crown of the root system gets buried by the mulch, and the mulch it's rotting wood. It's got a lot of fungus in it. It holds moisture, and that if the crown of the root system is kept damp by the mulch, you can introduce a whole range of diseases and problems to the fruit trees and to trees in general. It's similar to planting a tree too deep, mulching it too high.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep the mulch back 3 or 4 inches from the base of the plant is a great idea. Having mulch right up against it, you're sort of creating conditions for a certain set of pests and disease.
Okay, so you can pile it as deep as you want as long as you keep a certain area just right around the trunk clear, a couple
right.
inches.
And as deep as you want. I think 3 or 4 inches is probably optimal. 6 inches plus, you might be sort of just limiting, just slowing down the transfer of air and moisture from the atmosphere into the soil.
Those roots have to breathe.
The roots do have to breathe. Air is really important for plant roots. So another thing, that a lot of mulch in the winter is great because it's going to keep the soil temperatures, changing more slowly. However, in the spring, if you've got 8 inches of mulch over a plant, it's going to take the soil that much longer to warm up in the spring. So one thing you can do is you put it on a thick layer of mulch in the winter. The plant roots can grow a little bit longer. You're going to be comfortable all winter. And then as soon as the snow is gone, you can pull back that layer of mulch and let the soil warm up in the spring. And it's going to induce, more root growth in the early spring.
What do you recommend to make that easier? Do you remove the mulch from the site and put it in your mulch storage place or your compost bin?
Or? Pull it back, and as the tree grows, to get a broader and broader area that's had some mulch added to it. The mulch is also going to rot down in the series of a couple years.
Sure.
So to spread it out, and that really where as the tree matures, most of the roots that are actually feeding the tree are going to be much closer to the drip line than to the base of the tree, so that the area that actually is served by the mulch is going to be closer to the drip line, a little further out as the tree is growing.
And the drip line is?
The drip line. So if you had your picture of a tree, all leafed out, the drip line is the outer edge of the branches. So if you drew a line from the outer edge of the branches to the ground, that's referred to as the drip line.
So,
and that's the area where most of the roots feeding the tree are doing their work.
So if you come onto a tree after a storm and the skies are clear and the water's still dripping off the branches, that's the outer perimeter of that.
Right, the outer perimeter of the branches.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So feeding trees in the spring, that's also the area that you want to give the most attention is the drip line. People, it's not the base of the tree where the fine feeder roots are. It's going to be at the drip line.
And I understand that this is exactly the wrong time of year to be feeding trees right now, correct?
Yes.
It has been
true.
For several months.
And trees, at this point in the year, it may be late enough that you wouldn't be confusing the trees too much. Giving them some nutrients now, but the last thing you want to do right now is be inducing new growth, because the trees really should be pretty much stopping new growth. The wood that they've developed this year should be hardening off, so it's going to be able to withstand the Vermont winter. And that's one thing that can happen. Feeding plants too late in the summer or into the fall is that you end up inducing new growth that doesn't have an opportunity to harden off for winter and ends up getting destroyed over the course of the winter.
Sort of like giving us a big pot of coffee about 8 o'clock at night.
Exactly. You know, and something like compost this time of year is going to be slow enough and gentle enough that you're not going to be confusing the plant. But if you're, you know, using undecomposed manures, anything like that, any kind of fertilizer, really sold as fertilizer, might be a little bit too much for this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
If a few weeks from now, plants are going to be pretty much shut down, and you know, you can, you know, if you don't have time to do it in the spring, you can certainly do it in the fall, and it'll pretty much sit through the winter.
Mm. Well, I want to get your comment, Nico Rubin of East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield. I want to get your comment on other fruit harvesting opportunities right now. You can have your own fruit trees and then, you know, take care of them well and select exactly what sort of fruits that you want. This time of year, it's pretty readily apparent that there are a lot of unloved apple trees out there that are producing bounteous harvests that just fall onto the ground or onto the road.
Yeah.
You know people who go around and harvest those trees?
I think so. I mean, I know people, a lot of people looking to make cider, just driving around and stopping by various places. You know, a lot of the most productive trees are in people's yards, and that you know, one tree, if you're not on top of it, can produce far more fruit than you know, a family can, you know, is going to be eating fresh anyway.
Mm.
So that, you know, knocking on doors, most people are happy to have their yard picked clean of fruit.
Mm.
And a lot of the fruits, you know, processing into applesauce, cider, pies. All these things, you know, it's endless variety of things that we can do with this fruit.
Yeah, I have a friend in Marshfield who goes around and does exactly that. He has he's in his 80s and he just knows all these people with neglected apple trees and harvest them.
Sure, and if you keep your eye out this time of year, you can, you know, the trees are not too hard to spot. You know, a lot of trees just growing on the side of the road with no apparent owner, covered in fruit.
Mm.
It's a fantastic time of year to, you know, try some of the wild apples, you know, especially if you're making something like cider, to get some of these interesting flavors in there. So, you know, it's exciting.
Yeah, a lot of people really like the extra tang of the wild apples in their cider.
Sure. You get some bitters, which can be nice in a beverage. You know, it's that variety of apple flavors is fantastic. You know, to take a walk just going looking for wild apples this time of year is great.
And once you ferment the cider, then too, it kind of mellows some of those extreme tastes.
Yeah. Pears, you know, occasionally I'll see a pear tree also just dropping piles of fruit on the side of, you know, the side of the road, and easy to fill up a paper bag with pears and share them with your friends, make a sauce.
Mm.
They are a little less common here in Vermont, but hopefully we'll be planting a lot more of them. You know, it's also another nice thing about pears is that the quality of the fruit typically is much better than the quality of fruit on the apples in terms of having blemishes and, you know, little wormholes and everything like that. The skin on the pears often is a little bit thicker, and just because there's far fewer of them, the number of pests and diseases that afflict them are just much lower.
Well, I've certainly noticed that with my pear trees, and one of the curious things, though, is that I haven't really been able to make pear sauce or, you know, running them through a juicer, pear juice that's comparable to the apple juice or the applesauce that I make. The pear sauce in particular is just kind of, it needs some homogenization or something. There are lumps here, and then a lot of liquid that is just free liquid rather than being just sort of homogeneous in texture the way applesauce is. Do you have any tips on making good pear sauce?
It could be the pear varieties. You know, some have a larger grit cells than apples do typically, and that can be a little bit of a challenge. Mixing some of it with the apples. You could do something 50-50. Most, you know, in that case, most of the time, you're going to be able to get something more homogeneous. You know, smoother flesh pear, something like the Seckel pear or the Luscious pear, you're going to do a better job making sauce as opposed to the Parker pear, which is slightly larger grit cells.
What's a grit cell?
Grit cell. So the.
And do pears, we want to be eating them?
Yes, we're fine eating them, but that. So pears, I mean, most commercial pears have some some grit cells. They're sort of the small, sort of, I don't know, say sandy particles in, you know, in the flesh of the pears that sort of give it a different texture than you get in the apples. Some pears are more likely to produce grit cells than others, and that has some to do with growing conditions. You know, given very dry years, I think that the pears are going to form slightly more grit cells than in wetter seasons.
Why do plants do that?
It's why do they do that?
Yeah,
it's the pear variety, you know, and the grit cells. I mean that they're not unpleasant to eat if you're eating them, but in terms of saucing, you know, it's likely to make your sauce a little less evenly consistent.
Okay, well, I'll try throwing some apples in there and see if I get better results this year.
Sure.
So Nick Rubin of the East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield, we've been talking mostly about fruit trees here, but you also do quite a business in nut trees, and you think that that's an important part of our agricultural future, I understand.
Well, I hope that it's an important part of our agricultural future. It's certainly an important part of our ecological future. As a student of forest ecology here in Vermont, I spend a lot of time walking in the woods and seeing what's growing out there. All the animals out in the woods are really dependent on nut species to make it through the winter. You can eat a lot of berries out in the woods and not really get that many calories. So that the beech trees here in Vermont are a huge resource for the bears, squirrels, chipmunks, turkeys, birds. Everyone who's making it through the winter is really dependent on the nut trees, and we don't think that much about the nut trees in Vermont because we don't eat too many of them. A few people eat butternuts, which are a fantastic source of calories and dense nutrition growing wild, but also the beech nuts, which are much smaller and, you know, in terms of convenience of processing for people, you know, don't make a whole lot of sense. We also have acorns, though they're also a little less common here in central Vermont. But the nuts are fantastic and essential, really, for our local ecology to function as it does. But a lot of the nut trees are also afflicted by different diseases. There's a fungal blight carried by an insect that's really, really hurting the beech trees. There's also disease affecting the butternuts. You know, the butternut decline is pretty severe. It's really really challenging to find healthy looking butternuts. So to be planting a variety of nut trees that do perform well here, we can create the conditions to hopefully to help stabilize our local ecologies. Things like black walnuts do really well in Vermont, but they're just a bit less common. That they're not native to this area. They're more typically native a little further south, but they are hardy, and they do produce well, and that they're fantastic food for wildlife, and that they're pretty good food for people as well.
Do you sell blight-resistant varieties of butternuts and chestnuts?
No, I don't, and I'm really on the lookout for blight-resistant varieties. You know, there's some mention of people say, oh, this one does a little bit better. I haven't heard of anything that's fully resistant in terms of the butternuts, which is sad. And I think that, you know, certainly we can try growing the nuts ourselves, and experimenting with different kinds of management certainly is worthwhile. But I haven't heard of anything that's a consistently resistant butternut.
I was reading the book "Food of a Younger Land" by Mark Kalansky, or whether it was pulled together by Mark Kalansky. It's really a WPA, a Work Progress Administration, writer's project book from the 1930s. And they had writers on the dole, basically, around the country collecting information about food habits of people. And one of the reporters from Vermont reported on gave a recipe for butternut pickles. Have you ever had those?
Wow. I haven't. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. And I wondered if, I mean, there wasn't all that much from Vermont in this thick book, and I'm wondering if butternut pickles made it in there, if people were eating a lot more butternuts in the 1930s than
now. I think definitely that they were. You know, that a lot of the big old butternuts, or the trunks anyway, you see are by old farmhouses, you know, that to have a butternut tree was pretty common.
Uh-huh.
And that I think that a lot of the butternuts were probably planted originally by the indigenous people here. I read one account, perhaps in Changes in the Land by William Cronin, I believe, of a butternut maple cream that was served to, you know, early Europeans, and that they were, you know, it was an ecstatic description of the quality of this beverage that was the butternut cream, you know, mixed with maple sap.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah, sounded fantastic.
Mm.
So it's a food that sort of dropped out, and it does require a certain amount of processing to crack open the butternuts and pull out the nut meats. But it is something that is available. A lot of the other nuts that you plant, you talked about the Hazel Filbert hybrids. This is another nut that's, you know, very hardy. It seems to do really well in central Vermont. Grows more as a shrub and can produce prolifically. The nuts are pretty easy to crack and process, especially relative to something like a black walnut or a butternut. And the nuts are excellent for fresh eating, baking. It's also a nice, you know, high, good source of fat, which is nice to have trying to make it through a Vermont winter.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to my filberts and hazels and hybrids getting big enough to start producing some of those nuts for me and, I suppose, for the rodents in our neighborhood.
Yeah, they'll probably get a few.
Yeah. Nick Rubin of East Hill Tree Farm in Plainfield, you want to give us your website one more time?
Sure. The website is easthilltreefarm.com.
Easy to remember. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me on, Carl.
Okay. Bye. While we're talking about fruit and nut trees, I just want to put in a plug. There are all sorts of great pick-your-own places around here. I go to Liberty Orchard in Brookfield each year, and they have dominantly, not exclusively, but dominantly Liberty apples, a relatively new variety. It's a great apple, great eating, great for cider, great for saucing, just good all-around apple, and requires very little maintenance, very little spraying on it. They don't sell organic apples, but they're about as close as you can get to organic apples without being there, probably. So that's a good place, but there are all sorts of good pick-your-own places around here. It's a time of year to be out and getting your apples. It's also the time of year, apparently, to be looking at new energy sources for Vermont. Renewable energy, looks like we're going to have 50 megawatts more of renewable energy coming online in a very short time. This will be available at a price to the utilities which is higher than the average of what they pay for electricity right now. Is this a good bet for Vermont? What's it going to do for your energy cost, your reliability, and should we expand the program? We'll be talking with Andrew Perchlik. He's the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont, about that, plus their annual conference coming up in October, and other things related to renewable energy. We'll be right back after this. This is Carl Ettinger with Equal Time. We're going to be talking about all aspects of renewable energy here in Vermont with the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont, Andrew Perchlik. Andy, welcome back to Equal Time.
Hi, Carl. Thank you.
So I've been plugging the bit about the feed-in tariff, as it's called, or the standard offer, as it's also called, that the Public Service Board made a ruling on. Why don't you just give us a background of what this is and what's going on and what it means for our electricity here in Vermont?
This is a policy to promote renewable energy throughout the whole state for all different classes to see that anybody that wants to generate renewable energy has an easy access to the market, that they're just a standard offer. If you can generate electricity with renewable resources, you'll know what the price is that you're going to get for that electricity. And this is to overcome barriers in the past for smaller systems to negotiate contracts, that, you know, just to go through the whole negotiation process of the price and the contracts, but more to give them a price that makes it cost-effective for them to invest in these renewables. And this is a policy that's been very successful in other parts of the world and in Canada to really have a rapid development of renewables.
Mm. So this means higher prices for electricity.
At the beginning, I would say, yeah, the renewables in this standard offer, most of them, compared to prices today, are going to be, at all of them compared to prices today, are going to be at prices higher than the current market price that you can buy for natural gas power today.
That's good for Renewable Energy Vermont's members who are in the industry of providing renewable energy. Is it good for ratepayers in Vermont?
Yeah, we think it is. I mean, we think that all the research that's been done on what ratepayers and what citizens of Vermont want is they want more renewable energy, and they want more local renewable energy, and they're willing to pay some for it. The benefit of this power, even though it's more expensive today, you're locking in on the price for 20 years. And this is a very small percentage of our total portfolio, so we think it's a sound portfolio management to take a small percentage. This is only going to account for 5% of our total portfolio and lock it in on fixed prices for the next 20 years. As we don't know what the price of power is going to be over the next 20 years, but at least for this percentage, it'll be local, it'll be renewable, and it'll be stably priced so that we won't have any surprises. And we think people are willing to make that bet. It's almost like an insurance policy. You pay for it, but you get the assurance that the rate is going to be established and set for the whole time of the contract.
Well, it's worth remembering not too far back in history when the Hydro-Québec contract seemed to be so onerous because the prices for Hydro-Québec's electricity were so high. This was back in the 1990s that at one point the utilities were even suing, if I recall correctly.
Trying to get out of it.
And they couldn't, fortunately for us, because now those prices are some of the lowest around.
Well, they were for a while, especially like last couple years, that contract has been under market. But this for 2009, because of the economic slowdown, the demand for natural gas, the bottom pretty much fell off of the price of natural gas, and natural gas pretty much sets the price of electricity in New England, and also because there was so much production, because the price of natural gas was an all-time high, so anybody could produce it was producing it, so there was a glut on the market. So right now, electricity is cheaper than the Hydro-Québec contract, but after that, when it was higher than the contract for a few years, people started realizing the benefit of a long-term contract. Yeah, there'll be years when it's lower, but there'll be, you know, maybe more than half the contract where the price of electricity will be a lot higher. That's the benefit of a fixed-price contract. And we think there's all the other benefits of renewables, and we think the good thing about this program is these are renewables that will be built here in Vermont that regular people can build, but also that energy developers can go out and build. These will be projects under 2.2 megawatts, so it's not going to be giant wind farms or big power-producing plants. This will be, that for a homeowner, that's a big system, but for in the utility world, that's a very small system.
What about loopholes? What if I put in a 2.2 megawatt project, my sister puts in one right next door, and my dad puts in one right next to that?
They thought of that. There is restrictions in the law that for projects that use the same infrastructure can't be counted as separate systems.
Okay, well, there goes the dreams of the Etmeyer wind farm empire.
Right. And, what we found, what the legislature thought about not extending this standard offer to larger projects like the wind farms that are coming online or hopefully will be coming online shortly, was that they've been successful in being able to negotiate power contracts. The Sheffield project, for example, by First Wind, they negotiated contracts and they have fixed 10-year contracts with utilities on what the price of that electricity is going to be. At a time when Vermont Yankee and Hydro-Québec don't want to commit to a price, the renewable companies are more than glad to commit to long-term prices and saying, we know what our costs are up front, we're willing to set those prices, and we think that's a real benefit, and we want to increase the amount of electricity in our portfolio that's on these fixed-price renewable energy projects. So we'd really like to see these wind farms that are proposed or kind of slogging through the permit process to be recognized for the benefit that they're providing with these fixed prices.
No, that's worth underlining, that we have these contracts with Hydro-Québec and Vermont Yankee, and assuming that Vermont Yankee gets relicensed even, which is a big assumption, then they won't tell people how much they're willing to sell their electricity for. They haven't negotiated contracts with the utilities.
And
we don't know what it will cost.
Exactly. And part of that reason, the but the people are assuming the reason is that is because the market price is so low, and they don't want to publicly come out with a contract that's going to be a lot higher than the market price. Because for years they've been talking about how great Vermont Yankee Power is because it's so much lower than the market price.
Mm.
Well, right now what we're paying for Vermont Yankee is even over the market price. So they want to, you know, I think they're waiting and hoping that the price of electricity comes back up so they can offer a price that's at least at or below the market price.
Mm. So what's happening with this feed-in tariff program? The Public Service Board issued a ruling earlier this month and has another one coming up this week. What did those do to the process?
Yeah, the legislature set some temporary rates or suggested rates, and they asked the Public Service Board to look at those over the summer. And the board and all the utilities and other stakeholders spent a lot of time over the summer looking at the rates and the kind of rules of the program. Last week, or I guess 2 weeks ago, the board came out with their decision on the rates or the prices that the renewable energy projects will get. And they kept the prices that the legislature had set for the different technologies, except for farm methane system. They actually raised that price from 12 cents to 16 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's going to be a real benefit for farm-based systems. I think it's a little bit of good news for the dairy farms of the state that haven't had much good news lately, that they might be able to produce power with their manure at a price that they could make a profit on, and that would be encouraging more farmers to do that. Because before that, it was a very risky endeavor and a risky business. So some farmers had gone forward and done it, and we have some pioneers that were out there that took a lot of the arrows. But I think with this new standard offer, we'll see a lot of other farms be able to take advantage of this.
Hmm. So just to recap what you said, the Public Service Board, which is an independent quasi-judicial body, its members are appointed by the governor, took a look at this new legislation, the Vermont Energy Act of 2009,
mm-hmm.
and looked at its goal of providing adequate compensation to people building relatively small-scale renewable power facilities, and said basically the legislature got the prices right. We endorse this. Is that fair?
I think that's basic. And they're also going to relook at all the prices and the underlying assumptions in a decision that's going to come out in January of 2010, and that will set the prices for the next 2 years. So they said, for now, these prices will work. They're going to set the rules this Wednesday. They're going to come out with an order, or before if they get it done, that sets all the kind of rules and details of how the program will run, how you apply, all those kind of, what the fee will be, all those kind of details. And they might at that time put some limitations on the program as it's rolling out to make sure that they, if they didn't get the prices right, that their one technology doesn't run away and take up all the 50 megawatts, for example. So they might say, okay, we're setting the price for solar electric, for example, was set at 30 cents, but they might put a cap on that until January when they have more time to look at it to make sure that's the right price.
Hmm. So if somebody wants to build a project that would qualify for these feed-in tariffs, these guaranteed prices for a lifetime of a project, then how do they make sure that they're in queue to do that? Or don't we know until this ruling?
Well, the application with somebody that's called the speed facilitator is somebody that's going to work for the board that's going to facilitate these programs. And so that facilitator will take applications, and we won't really know the details until the order comes out, but likely to be an online application, fill out your paperwork, pay a fee, describe your system, prove that you have site controls and basic things like that, and then you would get in the queue. And just to make sure, it's not for the life of the project, it's 20 years. Some of these solar projects, for example, are very likely going to run past 20 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a 20-year contract, so you're guaranteed that price for that time. And we already have a similar program with net metering. You're guaranteed not a price, but you're guaranteed a value of your electricity, which is whatever you pay as your retail rate. So right now, all the systems going in the state are net metered systems, and that just gives you retail rate for it. No money changes hand, but you get the value when you're deducting that electricity off of your bill. And that is for the lifetime of the project. I think some smaller systems will probably still be better served by net metering, and then there'll be a certain size, and it'll depend on the rules what that cutoff is. It might be 15 kilowatts, or it might be 150 kilowatts, or
250 kilowatts, where it makes more sense to do the standard offer instead of net metering. And that'll all kind of sugar off when we get through the rules process and we see how the system works. But I think for sure we're going to see a lot more development of renewable energy in the state because of this new law, and that's what the legislature was looking for, and I think that's what the vast majority of Vermonters are looking for. They want to know what the holdup is. Why are we not moving towards this renewable energy future that everybody keeps talking about? We're up to date. We've been making progress, but it's been pretty slow. People would like to see things move a lot faster.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Andrew Perchlik. He is the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont. Well, as you've said, Andy, there's a cap on about 5% of the electricity portfolio for these renewable energy projects, 50 megawatts. How soon do you expect that capacity to be subscribed to with projects that are eligible for these feed-in tariffs?
It's really hard to tell. I mean, it was just kind of a wild guess. There's some people definitely think that the cap will be filled up this year, that a lot of projects will come in and want to fill in the cap. I don't think that's going to happen. I think a lot will come in. You know, we'll have maybe 10 or 20 megawatts that come into the cap. You know, maybe by the end of 2010 we'll have, you know, 30 or something megawatts. But I think a lot of those projects won't actually get built. You'll have a lot of people that will rush to get in line because they think they can do a project, but when they really look at the details of what it's going to take to do the interconnection to get it built, then a lot of those projects, they'll decide, wait a second, this isn't really, I don't have really the best spot for this, or things like that. It's not just, you just need any field anywhere and you can put in a megawatt solar system. The costs will be very different for interconnection depending on where your system is and different things like that. So we'll see a lot more renewables for sure, but I don't think it's going to be like a wild land rush kind of thing. I think it'll be more controlled once people really look at the rules and try to figure it out, and particularly getting through the interconnection process. Because, you know, we have a whole electric infrastructure that was designed on power flowing out to customers, smaller and smaller lines as you get further and further away from the big generators. But now we're talking about generating power out on the ends of all these lines and trying to feed the power back through these lines. And that's very different than the way use of the system that it was designed for, and that could cause a lot of engineering costs and interconnection costs that some people, I don't think, are prepared for. It's all good stuff, and it'll help to strengthen our electric infrastructure and help us move to the smart grid future that people want to see. But there's costs, and somebody's going to have to pay those, and complications that are going to slow down some projects. That I think that's going to slow us down a little bit compared to what people might be expecting is too fast of growth.
Interesting note of caution and skepticism there. It sounds like you're saying that it might look like a land rush in terms of the applications to the Public Service Board to qualify for these feed-in tariffs, but that a lot of the applications will not get built in quite the way that the developers thought.
Yeah, I mean, that is what I'm saying, but I should also say that it's all pure conjecture.
Sure.
And guesswork, sure. But that's from where my perspective, that's how I feel it'll work out.
Okay, well, take the applications that come in with a grain of salt. We're hearing from Andrew Perchlik, the Executive Director of Renewable Energy Vermont, when you're looking at the success of the renewable energy built as a result of the feed-in tariffs here. Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, the end result is projects that actually get built and producing power. That's what we want to see, and we'll definitely see a lot of that. The pace will be faster than it is now, but that should be the goal. That should be the measure that how we measure success or not, if we're actually getting these kilowatt hours produced.
And we got one of those over in Hinesburg, I understand.
Yeah, recently. It's not going to be in the feed-in tariff for the standard offer program, but Energy and Earth Turbines is going to be installing, I think it started running already, generating electricity this weekend, but it is the largest single solar system in the state now, and it's all on trackers in a field by NRG in Hinesburg. And I think we're going to see more and more of that, more of these kind of commercial, small utility scale PV projects. And Green Mountain Power, you know, the 150 kilowatt array that's in Hinesburg is the biggest one now running, but Green Mountain Power has a 250-kilowatt array planned for a facility that they have in Berlin next year. And I think with the feed-in tariff, we're going to see some proposals for megawatt solar farms. And so we're really going to see a rapid increase in the size of the systems. You know, a few years ago, somebody put in a 5-kilowatt system. That was a big deal. UVM put a system on one of their buildings, and it was a 5-kilowatt system. They kind of considered that a big deal at the time. Now a 5-kilowatt system is considered a pretty small, like a residential size system. So we're seeing the kind of ramp up of the industry that we were hoping to see.
A little bit at a time. This 150-kilowatt array is still less than 2% of 1% of the total electricity in Vermont.
Yeah, and the good thing about solar is that you can dispatch it throughout the whole state. And so you'll have a whole bunch of these 150-kilowatt arrays can add up to, I think, a significant percentage of our power over the next 10 years as we keep building these and build some megawatt-sized plants and have homeowners putting in. I think that's how other countries like Germany and Spain that's really seen a great penetration of solar into the market is everybody's doing it. It's not tons of big plants. It's little, thousands of little plants spread around everywhere.
Hmm. Well, we've got just about a minute left. Andrew Perchlik, can you tell us about your conference, which we'll be talking with your keynote speaker about in a month, Randy Udall?
Yeah. Randy Udall's keynote speaker. He's a great presenter, a real fun speaker. I think people should definitely come just to hear him and his perspective on energy policy. But the big thing I think for the general public to know is on the day before, the 28th, the Wednesday, from noon till 7 o'clock, it's going to be, the exhibit hall is going to be open for $10, and you can come in and walk the whole exhibit floor, which pretty much any renewable energy company in the state and several from surrounding areas will be there. So it's a great place to visit with a whole bunch of different renewable companies in a row. Also, we'll be offering a series of workshops that same day for the same price, so you can sit in on some, quick kind of basic renewable energy workshops on solar thermal or geothermal or solar electric, and those will be going on throughout the afternoon in one of the conference rooms, but the whole afternoon you can come in for $10 and walk the exhibit hall as well. So that's on Wednesday, and then Thursday is the day of the conference. The exhibit hall will be open that day too.
Quickly, your website?
revermont.org.
revermont.org, the website of Renewable Energy Vermont. We've been talking with Andrew Perchlik. He's their executive director. Andrew, thanks so much.
Thanks, Carl.
Energy, food, and the local economy is my theme here on Equal Time. We've been covering all of it. These are billion-dollar questions, where we get our food from, where we get our electricity from, and we're working through fruit and nut trees, small entrepreneurs like Nico Rubin of East Hill Tree Farm, helping us grow more of our food in our backyard on trees, and making renewable electricity that Vermonters are demanding here in our backyard. I'm Carl Ettenayer. That's it for Monday's Equal Time. I'll be back next Monday. Both Frankie Allen and Jack Donovan produced the shows today. Our archives are at equaltimeradio.com. Thanks for tuning in.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Amidst all the talk of peak oil, one very simple fact is often lost sight of. The world is using existing oil reserves far faster than new oil is being discovered. That's not a situation that can last long. World oil discoveries peaked in the mid-1960s. Technology has improved by leaps and bounds since then. An enormous amount of money has been expended on searching for oil. Yet world oil discoveries have never surpassed the levels achieved with 1960s technology. Why? The easy oil is already found. What remains to be found is generally further underground, or under the ocean, or in hostile environments like the Arctic, or in countries at war, or otherwise unstable. Starting in the early 1980s, the world's oil consumers have used up more oil each year than the industry could find. Some people take solace in impressive new finds. According to a recent New York Times article, this year could have the highest levels of oil discoveries since the year 2000. If the pace of discoveries in the first half of the year continues, we could be looking at 20 billion barrels of oil discovered this year. Sounds impressive, no? Except that 20 billion barrels is less than two-thirds of what the world will use in 2009. 2009 may be the most impressive discovery year this decade, yet the world would need discoveries to be more than 50% greater just to equal the amount of oil the world uses during a deep recession. Some in the industry say improved technology means that new discoveries are less important. If technology can squeeze more oil out of existing fields, then there's less need to discover new fields. Technology certainly has improved, but I'm not aware that it has reversed a decline in oil production anywhere. Texas, for example, peaked around 1970, and all the technological improvements since then have not pushed production above 1970 levels, no matter how high oil prices have climbed. It's not even clear to me what percentage of recently discovered oil will actually be produced. The New York Times article refers to many oil executives who say prices over $60 a barrel are necessary for much of the new oil to be profitable. At $70 a barrel now, oil is expensive enough for those new discoveries to be profitable, if prices stay the same. But they don't. The history of the last decade shows that oil prices are tremendously volatile. Last year alone, they dropped from nearly $150 a barrel to about $35. Expect the next decade to see prices at least as volatile as in the past. Will the industry be confident enough in the high average cost of oil to develop the new discoveries? What does all this have to say about peak oil for the world? Experts disagree about when world oil production will permanently peak and then decline. Some people think 2008 was a peak year. Others argue it could be 10 years or more in the future. But in individual countries where oil production has peaked and then declined, peak oil production has followed peak discoveries by 25 to 40 years. Add 40 years to the mid-1960s and you get a projected world oil production peak in the mid-2000s. That's not definitive proof that peak world oil production is already in the rearview mirror, but it's an interesting indication that it might be. The spate of announcements recently of new discoveries seems designed to lull us to sleep. Don't worry about peak oil, they seem to say. But you only have to think about them a little to realize that we're in trouble. The world has been using more oil each year than it discovers for nearly 30 years, and this year's discoveries aren't changing that. One commenter at the website theoildrum.com described the optimistic line well. He jiggered the quote from Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, who thought he'd negotiated a lasting peace with Hitler in 1938. "I believe it is peace for our time," is what Chamberlain said. And the commenter jiggered it to say, "I believe there will be no peak for our time." And then he goes on with the actual Chamberlain quote, "We thank you from the bottom of our hearts. And now I recommend you to go home and sleep quietly in your beds." Unquote. Don't go to sleep quietly in your beds. For gosh sake, continue to prepare for oil production shortfalls, high prices, and further recession. That seems the most likely medium-term outcome to me. I'm Carl Ettinger, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.